So people may continue to trickle in, but I think I'll go ahead and get started since we just have an hour. So my name is Maren Patalvin, and I am a physician. I'm a general internist. I work as a hospitalist, which means I take care of hospitalized patients. And I live in... I'm sorry?
Louder.
Okay. I live in Boston, and I work at the Cambridge Hospital, the Cambridge Health Alliance, which is one of the affiliated hospitals of Harvard Medical School. So I teach on the faculty there. And I'm a Christian. I grew up in the Lutheran Church and work now I'm a member of a United Church of Christ church in Boston. And I am not an expert in the conversation between religion and healthcare, but I'm interested in it and I'm curious about it, and the opportunity to pull together some thoughts for this week has been incredibly generative for me personally, and it has actually given me new insights into my work and the work that affects us all as human beings with bodies. This opportunity to engage you in questions that have become really generative for me will continue for me the process of my ongoing learning about it. So I'm not coming to you as an expert who knows all the answers to the questions that I'm asking, but I'm coming with questions that I want to engage you in thinking together with me about, because I feel as though, as Americans and as people of faith, as people with bodies, these questions are really critical questions for us to engage together as people and as a community of faith. So, because this is actually not an abstract conversation, and we are all people who have experiences with illness and sickness, I wanted to start by just grounding this in some of our own actual experiences. So I'm going to invite you to turn to the person next to you, just in pairs and dyads, and I want you to think about an experience that you've had of being ill or being sick. It might have been a personal experience, it might be an experience of a family member, but some experience you've had with illness. And I want you to just share that experience with the person next to you, so that as we begin thinking about these things, we're actually thinking about our own experiences and about the experiences of other people in the room. So I want you to just think about that experience and think about two questions as you share your experiences. What was your experience or the experience of your family member in the healthcare system? So how did the healthcare system respond to this experience of illness? And what was the role of faith and the faith community in this experience of being ill? And then we're going to just build some word pictures up on the board about these different domains. So 5 minutes, talk to your neighbor. So I'm just going to sort of bring us together and hope that's enough just to get the juices flowing so we remember what it is that we're talking about tonight. So just to harvest a few of the ideas from your little conversations, what different kinds of illnesses did you talk about, or what came up related to the experience of being ill? Just a few single word kind of answers. I'm just going to paint a little word picture about what does it mean to be ill.
Catastrophic accidents.
Okay. So certainly that is one kind of genre of illness.
A progressive chronic condition.
Okay. Anything else come up about sort of the experience?
End of life pneumonia or major...
Okay.
Also being a parent and helping your child through an illness.
So the family experience.
Misdiagnosis.
Excellent. So one of the things that's really clear about being ill is that you have sort of an inchoate subjective experience of being ill, and then it gets a name in the healthcare system, or it doesn't, and that affects the way in which the healthcare system responds. Yeah.
Is illness or a situation where Western medicine can't do anything?
So I'm going to put that over here, in that sort of you're encountering the limits of Western medicine. There's a set of assumptions, tools, names, and they don't always fit that illness experience that you have.
I have physical limitations.
Like disabilities?
Well, intractable, so yeah, I guess.
Or, okay, so the experience of being ill is an experience of being limited in some
limited.
Way.
Limited.
Yes. So one way of defining illness even might be something that gets in the way of living or participating fully in your life in the way that you want to live it.
Yeah, so this sort of, I don't know which pile it should go with, but I think of compartmentalization, and I think this happens with specialization in healthcare as well, that suddenly you're not the whole person, you are your broken hand or your heart attack or your, and it's the whole.
Excellent. So your experience of being a person that is ill is a whole person experience, but when you engage the healthcare system, you often have to engage it in parts. You go to one specialist or another specialist, and you have your experience with even one illness is the radiologist and the lab tech and the nurse and the clinic and the hospital and the ER. So lots of compartmentalization and specialization.
I think that
minor but painful.
So pain is an important experience of illness, and then this whole question of sort of minor versus major illness is pretty subjective. So something that the healthcare system might regard as minor might actually cause a significant amount of pain or disability or fear.
Like getting pulled into a healthcare process of how they do things and how they diagnose, and not feeling like you have a choice. You're in, and so I need to do it their way. I don't know how you.
Yeah. So the experience of taking this illness experience into the healthcare system is sometimes an experience where you're swept up. It feels like you're a part of some process that you don't even fully understand. So it's some sort of complex process. It seems to have rules. You don't know what the rules are. It feels like you're.
And loss of control.
Loss of control.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Ooh, there you go.
Yeah. So that's probably an experience over here. One of the experiences of being ill is a loss of many things, including control.
Also the polarization between the body and then the person or the mind or the heart is interesting. Like the focus is on the body, not on the holistic.
Yes.
Care of the holistic person.
So the healthcare response is really pretty clearly a limited focus on the body.
Yeah.
And then the end of life piece, at least as it pertains to my mother-in-law, was a loss of perspective and a kind of a focus on minutia. Mm. It was like instead of looking at her whole life and her quality of life, they were identifying specific things that they were going to try next.
Mm-hmm.
To it was real hard in the intensive care unit. It was like once we got her out of intensive care, then we were able to get hospice involved.
Mm-hmm.
And we were able to respond naturally.
Yes.
To the fact that she.
So your experience in the healthcare system was that the healthcare system was, it seemed to be inappropriately focused on technical details and had lost the forest for the trees and was incapable of helping you think about meaning and larger questions that actually matter as you're facing it. Absolutely. All right, so we've gotten actually several pieces about the way in which the healthcare system responds right now, or people's experiences in the healthcare system to these various kinds of illness experiences that they have. Anybody have any words to throw up about the way in which the church community or your own personal faith played a role in these illness experiences?
Well, my experience was much different than most of yours. My son was a total example of what happens when you lose your job,
mm-hmm.
and you don't find work for 2 years and you don't have any insurance, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he was really brilliant, and he found a way to get money. Because
mm-hmm.
there's funding out there if you know how to get it, and he did. He found it, and they did all these tests, and they found out he was riddled with cancer.
And so he decided that he did not want to have any chemo, and they did everything. The healthcare really responded to what he wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in charge until the minute he died.
Mm-hmm.
And they listened to him and they listened to me. So my experience was very different.
Oh, great. So it is possible.
But he was a very determined person, to say the least.
So it is possible, even in the midst of this bureaucracy and in the
compartmentalization, he never had a checking account.
It's possible if you, as a patient, come into the system with a clear sense of your own values and purpose and vision and a capacity to advocate for yourself and a way to listen.
Well, he was in charge of himself.
Yeah, it's
he didn't
possible.
Expect somebody to fix him.
It's possible to get patient-centered care, nurses. Yeah.
I mean, I think for the most part, the people, everyone that I've ever met in the healthcare have really cared for the people. I don't think I've ever had a person but I do think that the system, that they, even with their care, that they get caught up in the rules, and I think it's litigious rules is what has driven it, has created a monster, you know, that they can't even do the things that they're best at, which is relating, which is taking the time that you need as a distressed relative or parent or whatever, and that's the dilemma.
So there is the capacity for these caring one-on-one relationships, even though they're swept up.
The
in
people are there
in some of this complex, larger bureaucracy.
In our conversation, one of the faith issues was that the invitations from people of faith sort of evoked more energy in this old person who was struggling with her convalescence. The invitation to participate in life evoked all kinds of energy. Nobody believed she was capable of doing this, but when she was invited by somebody from her church to go along or do something, she just blossomed and was able to do stuff that people couldn't believe.
So invitations to participate and to connect and to stay in a relationship that might come from a church can be healed.
Where this fits in, but I'll share it. It's talking about faith. Tom and I were in a real serious car accident in the mid-90s. And we ended up in Miles City, Montana at a hospital. I had a brain concussion. I was in pretty tough shape.
Lots of glass.
Catholic hospital. And what I remember to this day is Sister Mary. I remember the doctors, but what I remember is the ministry and the nurses. I mean, I thought I'd died and gone to heaven. Really? I'll never forget that.
So you actually
hospital.
Had an experience in the hospital.
Yes, the
being
ministry.
Ministered to by.
Oh, the minute I was in there. I tell you, I'll never forget that place. Yeah, it was amazing.
And is Sister Mary, was she a chaplain within the institution?
No, she was a nurse. Mm-hmm. There was a chaplain too, but I mean, they were all, they prayed with me right away. Can we pray for you? And yes, please. Mm-hmm. You know, I was half with, not even with it at first, but Tom knows.
They were really very loving, and I think it's part of the healing. Cause
so this was an explicitly church-affiliated hospital that was not afraid to...
They asked if I was open to it, of course. Yeah.
But she knew they were praying. Their Christian attitude came out. They, from that aspect. So, there was a comfort there.
Mm-hmm. They dumped me in a tub of water because I was covered with glass all over, accident. And they were picking it out. I remember they were praying when they were picking it out. I know it's pretty unusual. Mm-hmm. So if you need to help, Miles City, Montana.
I bet you they're not there anymore. Look at Providence, Mount St. Vincent.
Could be, I don't know. This was in that middle of
the 90s. They sold out to Swedish.
Yes, you have that.
We have several personal experiences with accident, illness, where our church committee that we're very involved in just gave a tremendous amount of support, logistical support, meals, just stopping by, mowing the lawn, whatever we needed, and coordinated. Somebody stepped forward as a coordinator, and kind of handled putting people in charge of what they what their gifts were, and so it's just.
Yeah, so a lot, I think a lot of church communities provide instrumental support, is what the language of social support research would call that, meaning giving you rides, giving you meals, that kind of domain. Any other thoughts about the role of the church?
We had a, or I, well, we both did have a, had a kind of, I don't know if it's going to be unique anymore, experience when we went for our last physical, because we have a new physician. He seems to be very caring and everything, but the physical was sort of a hands-off type of thing where they just ask questions and that kind of thing that are put to them, and they're given a certain amount of time, and there isn't time for anything else. You don't have any input of what I usually did. You know, when I got to a physical, I would say, you know, well, this has been happening, and there was no room for that. And so it.
So you had an experience in the healthcare system where the healthcare response felt rushed and hurried. And
yeah, it seems like it was coming, you know, top down from Medicare.
Mm-hmm. And no hands on.
And no hands on.
So it seemed as though people were driven by external mandates and
right,
not necessarily by their own sense of what you needed and.
It was sort of like this person was a rule follower,
yep.
You know, and was going to do it the way he was told to do it.
Mm-hmm. Great. So this was just to get the juices flowing. I wanted to just paint some word pictures of the experience of being ill, the experience people have engaging the healthcare system, good and bad, and the experiences that people have in thinking about the role of the church or their faith. We could probably expand this list a little. I think many people pray for healing and have the experience of praying for others. I mean, just about every Sunday, I think, in every church across the country, when there are prayers of the joys and concerns from the community, the prayers usually turn towards people who are ill or people who are engaging the healthcare system in some way. So I think it's a big part of our language within church communities that we care about people who are suffering with physical illness. I'm going to give just a sort of brief overview of what I've learned in reading in the last few months about the history of this conversation between healthcare and religion. On black screen, there we go. You know, I think that we know that themes of health and wholeness and shalom and healing and suffering and pain, the Bible is replete with these themes. And so trying to put a little context around it is challenging. But I'm going to give just sort of a 15-minute overview, 30,000 feet, of sort of how I think we got to where we are today. Let me just offer this frame as a way of getting started before we move into a historical timeline. So there's a Catholic Franciscan monk who is also a general internist, and he's written several books about the relationship between health and spirituality. His name is Daniel Solmassi, and he would look at the three word portraits that we put on the whiteboard and would see in them these three dialectics. So he would say that on the one hand, the experience of being ill is a subjective experience, but the experience of getting help is an experience in which your subjective experience turns into an object. And that is a fundamental tension in the way in which any culture of any time has to engage the experience of being ill. That this is we hold these two things in tension, the subjective experience of being ill and the need to objectify. Another dialectic here is that the experience of pain and suffering and illness is actually part of an infinite problem. We are sort of by definition broken and mortal, And so we live finite lives, but our need for and desire for healing is a sort of infinite desire. And so every healthcare system, our American healthcare system included, is a finite response to an infinite human need. And therefore, it is an insatiable need. You can never actually meet the infinite human need for healing. And that's a tension that every healthcare system, whether it's a very primitive tribal healthcare system or a very complex bureaucratic system, struggles with. And similarly, there's a tension between the universal and the particular, meaning that the human condition is a condition of, it's a universal state of being human, that we are mortal and that we suffer, but yet, the particular manifestation of illness in an individual life, in an individual family, requires a particular response, even though it's a manifestation of a universal human condition. And these dialectics actually undergird a lot of the tension that we have in thinking about how good is our healthcare system, what should it be like, what does it need to do. So I think you'll hear these as I go through the sort of timeline. So in the earliest part of the Hebrew Bible, you find passages like this: I, the Lord, am your healer. See now that I am He, and there is no God beside me. It is I who put to death and give life. I have wounded, and it is I who heal, and there is no one who can deliver from my hand. And this is the most ancient, I would say, Judeo-Christian notion of God and healing, that all healing, all illness, all suffering, all death, all life comes from God. And the earliest history in our Judeo-Christian heritage is one in which, although there was certainly in the world in which our ancient tribal ancestors lived, There was a lot of, there were shamans, there was a kind of traditional healing practices. The Judeo-Christian heritage is one that was suspicious of these healers, and so the ancient Jewish tribes were actually suspicious of healing that seemed to not come from God. So there was some tension in the way in which our early ancestors thought about the role of healers who were not God. Prophets, as you know, played a role as healers. There are several stories in the Old Testament of prophets working miracle cures. This is a portrait of Naaman being washed by Elijah and having the leprosy washed from his skin. And here's Elijah bringing a widow's son back to life. So there are these isolated incidents of prophets working healing miracles. The Psalms are full of stories of individual people who are crying out in their illness. And so you can see in the history of the Psalms, basically a history of the human response to illness. And you can find in the Psalms just about every human response to illness that we see today. So you can find people who are angry at God, you find people who are praising God for His goodness, even in the midst of suffering, you find people who are who have lost faith, who are despairing, and the Psalms are full of these laments. There is no soundness in my flesh because of thine indignation. There's no health in my bones because of my sins. My wounds grow foul and fester because of my folly. I'm bent over and greatly bowed down. I go mourning all day long. My loins are filled with burning. There's no soundness in my flesh. And then another example of Psalms: I am so troubled that I cannot speak. Has God forgotten to be gracious? Has He in anger withdrawn His compassion? Then I said, it is my grief that the right hand of the Most High has changed. I shall remember the deeds of the Lord. Surely I will remember thy wonders of old. I will meditate on thy work and muse on thy deeds. So here the suffering voice is turning to God and remembering God's greatness even in the midst of his suffering. So the Psalms are songs of human responses to illness. And then in the history of the relationship to the church, the next kind of most important chapter is actually recorded in a book which is an apocryphal book, so it's a part of the Catholic canon, but not a part of the traditional Protestant canon. And it's interesting because the tribal Jewish people, it seems, were suspicious of physicians and human healers. And what was happening in the secular world is that all around the Judaic, the Hebrew tribes, the secular world was actually finding new herbs and new ways of responding to illness, and it looked as though some of those herbs were effective. And so there was this tension within the Jewish people about how to engage these physicians and how we should think about physicians in relationship to God. If God is the healer, what is the role of this physician? And the book of Ben Sira actually articulates a way of thinking about physicians in relationship to God. So this text says, honor physicians for their services, for the Lord created them. Their gift of healing comes from the Most High, and they are rewarded by the King. The skill of physicians makes them distinguished, and in the presence of the great, they are admired. The Lord created medicines out of the earth, and the sensible will not despise them. Was not water made sweet with a tree in order that his power might be known? And he gave skill to human beings that he might be glorified in his marvelous works. By them the physician heals and takes away pain. The pharmacist makes a mixture from them. God's works will never be finished, and from him health spreads over all the earth. My child, when you are ill, do not delay, but pray to the Lord, and he will heal you. Give up your faults and direct your hands rightly and cleanse your heart from all sin. Offer a sweet-smelling sacrifice and a memorial portion of your choice flower, and pour oil on your offering as much as you can afford. Then give the physician his place, for the Lord created him. Do not let him leave you, for you need him. There may come a time when recovery lies in the hands of physicians, for they too pray to the Lord that he grant them success in diagnosis and in healing for the sake of preserving life. He who sins against his maker will be defiant toward the physician. So you see sort of emerging this this kind of theology that makes space for the physician, because suddenly the physician seems to have some things that are useful. And so this frame where Ben Sira says, the physician is actually working in a covenant with God. So therefore, God can heal through the physician. It's possible to make space in our theology for these physicians. And this frame actually governed the next chapter in the history of the relationship between religion and the church. Obviously, we know that Jesus was very busy healing people. I was, as a part of a Lenten series this past spring, I was studying the book of Mark, and I was really struck by how much healing Jesus did. It was really sort of the centerpiece of his ministry, and it made me think a lot about these stories of Jesus and what it means for us today. My hope is that we'll have a chance to look at a couple of these stories before we close today, but if not, we will on later days. The early church was also very busy with these faith healing exercises. So the apostles were charged with healing, and there are stories in the book of Acts about the apostles healing people who were lame, people who were paralyzed, people who were blind, casting out demons. It was a big part of the early church and its community. And then as Christendom evolved, this is portrait of Constantine and his mother Helen, and it is believed that the very first hospital was established by Helen, who was Constantine's mother, and it was a part of a commitment to Christian ministry and healings, central to the understanding that people had about what it meant to be a Christian. And then during the Crusades, it was the Crusades that actually created the hospice movement. They created mobile hospices and hospitals for Crusaders who were ill and dying. And then the monasteries in the Middle Ages became places where people studied botanicals and herbs, and they developed the biology and science of medicine, and they became places where ill people came to be healed. This is a portrait here of John Wesley, who, like many of the early church fathers and church reformers, was very interested in human health and human healing. This is a picture here of an electrical machine in which he would induce seizures in patients, and he had a list of some 47 conditions that he thought were treatable with this electrical seizure-inducing machine. Here's a picture of Cotton Mather, who was, as you know, a famous Congregationalist minister from Boston, who was responsible for actually inventing the smallpox vaccine and was a very important player in the public health infrastructure of New England in his day. So the relationship between the church and the delivery of health and healthcare was actually pretty tight. This is a picture of the lobby at Johns Hopkins Hospital, where they have this very large statue of Jesus, and the base of the statue says, "Come unto me, all you who are weary, and I will give you rest." And this, I think, kind of epitomizes the birth of the hospital movement in the United States, which was very much an outgrowth of the church. You'll notice that many, many hospitals today have the name of a church in them. There's New England Baptist and New York Presbyterian. And the church
was Providence. I mean, that was St. Sister Joseph. I mean, she brought that whole thing to Seattle.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. Hospitals were, in the early part of this century, a place where people could go. If they couldn't afford a private physician who would come to their home, it was a place for people to go who were poor and had no other options for healthcare. And somehow, between 1910 and 2012, the relationship between the church and healthcare institutions and hospitals has changed dramatically. Sense of what has driven that. What would you all, because it looks to me as though the church and healthcare delivery systems were integrally intertwined for most of the history of Christianity. And I would say that things have changed in the last 100 years, and particularly in the last 50 years. So what's changed?
And the separation, the interpretation of separation of church and state.
Hmm.
Because the hospital became more state-run or whatever, that the government wanted the church out of it.
I think the growth of scientific knowledge.
So, the separation of church and state, the growth of scientific knowledge. The growth of scientific knowledge is huge, right? Because up until this point, really, the science of medicine had very little to offer. So, germ theory is at the turn of the century. So what physicians were offering was not so very different from what non-physicians had to offer in terms of caring, right? But it was 1920 when we actually developed insulin. It was 1930s when we developed vaccines and anti-sera, and the 40s when we developed some antibiotics. And the last 50 years, the number of pharmaceuticals, the amount of imaging testing, the birth of molecular medicine, the rise of science and the rise of scientific thinking in medicine has made it possible for people to assume that through human ingenuity and human, the pursuits of human science, we've been able to unravel what causes disease and what actually makes it better. We don't need to invoke God anymore. It feels as though science is offering an answer to this infinite problem. So it feels as though science is not a finite solution, but an infinite. Yeah.
On this, I guess I can't remember the guy's name now, the doctor. I'm talking about when he will not take a patient unless the patient has family around him. He's got something serious like doing heart work. That unless he has somebody.
He's on TV.
Dr. Oz. But his statement was that unless the person has somebody caring about him or her, that he doesn't really want to deal with that person because of that will to live. And in the midst of all this, I can still feel that at least some physicians feel that they need some kind of a connection with God, with their family. If they're just alone, he doesn't want to deal with it because percentage-wise, it doesn't work out.
Yeah, I think many physicians actually feel the same limitations that patients feel in regard to the way in which the healthcare system has evolved.
So with all this complexity, you mentioned healthcare has become an industry, which then allows a profit to be driven. So things of that large and integrated nature are either corporate or they're government.
Absolutely. So I would say that the rise of medical technology has driven the development of this huge medical industrial complex. The success of science has actually managed to draw a lot of resources into the business of healthcare. So we have increasing complexity in the economic, political, and social relationships that that we have constructed to deliver healthcare to people. And that is, in part, public resources, which has then drawn private resources, and that has also led us into the way in which our economy has evolved, has made debt financing possible, and so the hospitals become growth industries, and they get bigger and bigger and bigger, and they demand, they have a logic of their own that's created by their role in the marketplace that actually gets quite divorced from the human need that they were evolved to respond to. Yeah.
And the other part of that that's huge is the whole growth of insurance that has come, is driven right between the patient and then the medical care, and it's become bigger than the medical industrial complex, I believe.
Yes, I would put insurance into this medical industrial complex.
How big is
complex.
So big?
Profit motive by the capitalistic culture that has, yeah, I mean.
Yeah, I think it's a very complex question. I don't have a simple answer to it.
Yeah.
But I think it's related to the growth of all this technology.
It has so much power.
I mean, that's a real problem, by the way. I mean, my doctor tells me all the time all the power the insurance company has, and it drives him crazy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I believe that it's been, you talked about early 1900s, from 1910, say, to 2012, the changes that have happened. And I think within that time, insurance did not exist, essentially, as a mechanism within the culture prior to 1910. And I don't know when it came out,
it was in the
30s and 40s.
It was in the
20s and 30s. And it really became powerful in the late 50s and 60s.
Right.
Again, I think as this stuff, I agree with you that the cost of medicine is what drove the insurance.
But it started with the auto industry that was trying to recruit employees. And so they added the benefit, and then they sought tax benefits for what they were doing as a benefit to their workers, as a way to get workers. And then that was adopted as, well, geez, it worked for the autos, maybe we can extend this idea. And so private insurance then grew in response to that activity, and it became social policy.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until the 60s when we got a public turn on that with Medicare and Medicaid.
Yeah, and also big corporations signed up their employees. Remember Boeing? I remember when that happened.
But with the rise of that industrial medicine thing and with the rise of scientific knowledge has also come a rise in our expectations and our demands for what healthcare does for us. And we forget that when we talk about, I mean, we've sold our souls in a sense, our bodies and our souls, to a system that can deliver a lot of things, but there's a huge price.
So we have, if you go back to those original kind of dialectics that Daniel Salmasi put forward, I think we have allowed ourselves, not just as patients, but also as doctors and as the healthcare system, to believe that these finite responses that we have to this infinite need are actually infinite responses. And so absolutely, this medical consumerism is a huge part of what drives this industry, that we have now a sort of insatiable demand for more certainty in a domain where fundamentally we have uncertainty, because we actually cannot have what at some level we seem to behave as though we want. And this is driven in part by us as consumers and in part by the supply that is continuing to drive us.
We know what the possibilities are for healing. And we look at, for instance, Canada. I mean, where people have to wait. If they get cancer, they have to wait for their medicine, which is socialistic. And yet we want that, and we think that it's not going to happen to us, I guess.
Say that again, I didn't understand what you said. Take Canada, okay.
In Canada, if someone gets cancer,
yes.
These are stories I hear, so I don't have firsthand information, but they have to wait for their turn to come to get the medicine that they might need, or whatever the tests that they need, and that type of thing. And they have socialistic medicine. We think that if our government takes over our medicine, we will get those things.
And we want
we'll not have to wait.
Okay,
we'll get it.
Understand.
Well, I think in Canada, if you have an elective procedure, if you need a knee replacement, you wait. But if you have cancer, you don't win.
Yeah, that's my understanding.
Well,
yeah.
I had two friends up in Canada, and they had cancer. They had excellent care right now. Right now.
Yeah.
Well, our daughter was in England when she had her first child, and she had wonderful care.
Yeah.
And that's a
But
of course, it's a smaller country.
Yeah, so there are, I think, a lot of lessons to be learned from other countries and comparative health systems and what works
I did want to say that I didn't know.
Yeah.
I mean, this was all secondhand information.
Yes, I'll get you
such a cop-out.
So because we have this extraordinary kind of reader reactor of increasing cost and increasing technology and increasing money in the system, and it's driven by this fundamentally infinite demand that we have for health and healing and wholeness, there are all sorts of strategies to try and manage this insatiable growth. And most of that attempt uses a language which is utilitarian. It's all about ways of rationing and ways of making decisions. It's necessary to actually have conversations in this utilitarian domain, and every national health service in every other country, like Canada or England or other Western European countries, engages in a conversation about how are we going to manage finite resources in order to meet public good. And that is a fundamentally important conversation that we as a country need to participate in. And we actually, as a country, have been actively participating in that conversation over the last 2 years, particularly around the Affordable Care Act. I would argue, in the context of this conversation that we're having here, that these utilitarian conversations are never going to actually go quite far enough because we have these fundamental spiritual tensions.
Fundamental what?
I think we have this fundamental spiritual need for healing, which is never going to be met by our healthcare system.
Yeah, then we should hire a shaman at the same time.
And so I am deeply aware that even if we figure out how to reapportion the money that we're currently spending on our healthcare system, we aren't actually going to produce the kind of wholeness and health that we actually imagine for ourselves and for our communities and for the world, because the language within the healthcare system actually is not a language that engages spirituality. It's not a language that engages some of these more fundamental questions about what it means to be human and what gives it a meaning. So I feel like our public debates are missing a very important voice that without this voice, I don't think we're actually going to be able to find our way to the kind of healthcare system that we need. That we
I agree with you totally.
I think that there are all sorts of ways in which that conversation is already starting and is underway and has never stopped because it's a fundamental part of what it means to be human and to be ill and to be seeking human. But it's absolutely not the dominant culture narrative. It's a subculture narrative and it doesn't have a lot of power. As we'll see later in the week when we look at more closely at the Affordable Care Act, there's very little conversation about the role of spirituality and healing, or there's not really a lot of conversation about healing, actually, in the conversations right now about the healthcare system.
Is there something in terms of the decline in spirituality and faith communities, and, you know, the decreasing belief?
What do you think?
Well, I'm just wondering, that's going to drive some of this back to utilitarian and eliminate some of the people that are going to...
Yeah. I mean, the church doesn't have a very... the progressive church doesn't have a very loud voice in conversations about health and healing.
Like, you're talking about, like, laying on the hands and the prayer groups. Is that what you're talking about? What are you talking about?
Well, I think that...
Or Leo Dossie, wasn't that the guy that was the doctor that prayed over his patients? He wrote books about it.
So I think that there's certainly a role for doctors praying for their patients, and there's a role for healing services within church communities. But I'm actually talking about a more, I think, a deeper critique of the challenge that we have in thinking about meeting the health needs of the public, meeting the health needs of the people within the community. And that is that as long as we have a scientific kind of technological approach to thinking about the human body as a machine that develops malfunctions and therefore it needs to be
fixed.
We have, I think, in our dominant culture within healthcare, we have a paradigm of what it means to be human that is actually pretty limited. And unless we can reinvite into our conversation about what we're trying to do in healthcare, as we can reinvite a larger notion of what it means to be human and what it means to be whole, we actually are not going to be able, I don't think, to create the kind of healthcare system that we want. And I don't think it necessarily is a recipe for spending more money on healthcare. In many ways, the things that I'm talking about, as we'll see as we get into some of these Bible stories over the course of the week, that the healing that is offered by Jesus is absolutely free. There is no money that changes hands in any of the healing stories that we read about in the Bible. And so it's not necessarily the case that thinking more broadly about what it means to be human will translate into more money in our healthcare system. It's just a different frame, but what are the goals? What are we trying to accomplish?
Well, I think what is health is part of what, you know, what are the layers of health and what creates health in us. I mean, we struggle with that even with our children in terms of how do you create healthy children, which has to do more than just their physical body, which mm-hmm. has to do with their sense of community and their sense of
Absolutely.
Spirituality and their, you know, what do we need within our culture, and how then do we fit the medical care back into that so that it's subservient in a sense to the health of the community as opposed to something that's up here and just making money.
Absolutely. So these are the themes that I hope to explore this week, is what is the relationship between health and healthcare? What is the relationship of the health of the individual to the health of the community? And how do we engage as a community in thinking about creating conditions for health and wellness? And what role do we expect the medical care system to play in that? What role should it play?
I just can't help but think of the most recent Medicare exam I had, in which the questions were asked about how do you feel, how are your pains and that. And when I got through, I said, well, you know, I'm 72 years old. I expect to have more pain. You know, so what, I feel fine. But I have pain? Yeah, I have pain. I can't do what I did before. You know? So it becomes kind of a ridiculous, because I know I'm not going to live forever. I'm finite. Mm-hmm. And that's where my faith comes in, is it gives me the peace of accepting these things. Mm-hmm. But then I go to television, and I see these great, not great, I see these ads about how I should live, how the world thinks I should live. Mm-hmm. Your erectile dysfunction and all this kind of stuff. And I'm thinking, what the hell is this all about? You know, come on, get a life. You know, I mean, sir, I don't mean to be rude about it,
yes,
but I mean, it's the world is setting up expectations. And I think I'm comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Let me be comfortable with it. And I like to treat myself for a lot of things that I don't have to go to the doctor for. I think, well, I can deal with this. Mm-hmm. I did. So, mm-hmm. there you go.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's why there's a really interesting conversation between the one we're having here and the one next door on consumerism and what it means to be a consumer culture.
Mm-hmm.
Because I definitely think that we are sold a bill of goods about what's possible, what makes a life good, what makes it meaningful, what makes it successful,
and that's
what makes it satisfying,
fee.
And the healthcare industry participates in that in a very complex way.
Yeah. Well, just sort of the other side of that thing about my father-in-law, who was having all sorts of mobility issues and pain as he enters in his 80s, and had seen lots of specialists, had lots of studies, was on multiple medications, and was not very happy, wasn't feeling like his life was very full. And so the answer was, I'm going to go for this special workup at Mayo. And so he went, and he actually lived at Mayo for 4 days, and they did all of these studies to the tune of like $30,000 to $40,000. And in the end, he was on the same medications with no new diagnoses and no change in his health care. And the bottom line is, he felt some peace. And I was having this conversation with him about the irony of sort of we can talk about policy and how we're going to spend dollars, but in the end, there was this incredible waste of money, really. And I think he still feels like his life is just as limited. And because he's not at peace with his finite self, so it's just a...
I think you hit the head, nail right in the head. I deal with this a lot with where I work, and I see a difference between people of faith. If they come in to get a devastating diagnosis that they're about to die, or they may not even be able to speak for themselves, but their family people with faith make the decision quickly and they accept what's happening. People of less faith, I see they drag things on, they have family infighting, they don't know what to do, and you know, what you may or may not believe, but the physicians don't necessarily control the patient's death. It's directed by family and the patient. So sometimes a lot of us sitting around will know that this person is, they're on their way to heaven. They're not. But the family has disagreements, so they want to keep pushing forward. They want that miracle to happen. And the physicians, the healthcare staff, their hands are kind of tied under our current laws that we have to provide the treatment as the family dictates. And you see a lot of money wasted in that sense for, you know, the lost cause. Excuse me, I'm a little bit cynical. I've been in business for a long time, so, you know, it's, and not just end of life, there's also people who don't care about their health, but they come to the hospital every time their health declines because they don't treat themselves. I can tell you, I know somebody that's 21 years old has probably used well over $1 billion of healthcare services, more than probably any of us will use in our lifetime, because he simply won't take his insulin. So, and you've got many people like that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I'm aware that it's 7:15 and we need to close. So I think the conversation has actually in many of the themes that I hope to continue to explore over the course of the week. Here's the agenda for the next 4 days. So tomorrow's theme is specifically related to public health and health justice, and we'll be looking at health inequities. Day 3 is specifically on the Affordable Care Act and trying to alleviate Obamacare through a biblical lens, recognizing that we live in a very different world than the world of the Bible. And so trying to glean lessons that we can find, what can we take that's actually useful to us, that helps us think about the actual challenges that we're facing today from a public policy perspective. End-of-life care, I think, is a natural place for thinking about these questions, and so Thursday is dedicated to that. And on Friday, we're going to try to be a little bit more constructive in thinking about not analyzing current situations, but actually thinking about ourselves and our own health and our role as healers. Because I think that all of the healing stories in the Bible call us not only to think about our own need for healing, but also about our responsibility to be healers. So I look forward to continuing the conversation with you all in the week. Thanks.